Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Aquadocs, the podcast that keeps you up to date on all things aquatic medicine. I'm your host, Michelle Greenfield. This week, I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Brittany Stevens, veterinarian at the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach and at the California Science Center in Los Angeles, California. Today, we're going to talk about an amazing case focused on saving the life of a moray eel called Elena. So let's jump right in. Hi, Dr. Stevens. Welcome to Aquadocs.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. I'm super excited to talk about this case that you're going to be discussing today because eels are something I've never worked with. And so hopefully our listeners are going to enjoy this case discussion. But before we get there, can you tell our listeners about an experience that you had that really helped shape who you are today as a veterinarian?
Yeah, when people ask me how I got into this field, I actually always knew I wanted to do this. I went to SeaWorld as a young child at like 4 years old, and I saw all the fish there and all the marine mammals and the sea turtles, and I was like hooked. I was just like, wow, that is the most cool thing. I definitely want to do that. So I actually really thought I wanted to be a marine mammal trainer, and I thought about doing psychology. My mother is a human physician, and so one day I had the epiphany. You know what? These animals need a doctor themselves. I actually really thought I wanted to do marine mammals medicine and was focusing my career down that way. I volunteered at a marine mammal center down here in San Pedro. Then I also had the opportunity to study abroad during college. I studied abroad at the University of Queensland, marine biology and terrestrial ecology. And that was kind of my first real introduction to fish. And I did two research projects out there on the Great Barrier Reef. I had to go snorkeling 2 times a day at minimum and count fish and do transects on the Great Barrier Reef for about a month.
Wow.
That was pretty awesome. So fell in love with fish. And after that point, now I really do. I like fish because there's not very much known about them. We know a lot more about mammals, even the marine mammals, because they're very similar to dogs and cats, which we study a lot in vet school. But as probably a lot of your listeners know, there's not that much out there about fish medicine. So you're really lucky to get a course in fish medicine. Not that many textbooks or basic things known about, like what is a normal CBC for a lot of our species. We don't even really know. So I think it's a great field that's wide open for different research areas. And I love clinical medicine and clinical research. And that's where I've been directed ever since.
Super, super cool. And so now you go from a potential marine mammal career to more fish career. And as we were talking offline, your facilities right now don't even have cetaceans.
Yeah, that's true. But we do have at the Aquarium of the Pacific seals, sea lions, and sea otters. So actually, I'm okay with that. As you might have heard, cetaceans are a little bit of drama queens. I will take my pinnipeds and my sea otters, and I'm quite happy with it. I love the variety of what I get to see at our aquarium. We have everything from a lorikeet forest to jelly touch tanks to shorebirds to sea turtle rescue rehab. We do some sea otter surrogacy programs. And then, of course, all of our elasmobranchs and our fish. So I love it that I never have a day where it's the same. You know, it's a surprise. What are you going to get to work on today? A frog, and then you're going to go see a penguin, then you're going to see a lorikeet, then you're going to go look at a harbor seal's eye, and then you're going to come back and work on a sea star. So that's what I really love about my job in the aquarium world.
And you get to do it between 2 different facilities. So you have double the species range.
That's true. Yeah. At the California Science Center, which is my other facility that I work at, we have mostly aquatic species, but we also have a little bit more terrestrial animals. We have a desert exhibit. So we have Gila monsters and fennec foxes. So lots more herps at this facility and a couple more terrestrial critters and some birds. So it's a good mix of everything.
That's amazing. What a perfect balance. I love that. I'm still fixating right now on this touch tank of jellyfish. So are these moon jellies?
They are moon jellies. Yeah. So we let the people do with a gentle 2-finger touch. They can touch the dorsal bells of the jellies. So it's actually pretty cool because everybody thinks that jellies are going to sting you. So it gives our educators a good way to talk about nematocysts and that they don't have them on the top of their bells and that not all jellies sting with the same amount of severity. So people love it.
That sounds so much fun. Clearly I need to go fly to California and go gently play with 2 fingers with these jellyfish. All right. Well, I want to transition now to talk about a really cool case that you worked on with Elena. Yes, you heard that right. Elena, the California moray eel. So can you tell our listeners about this case and what she presented with?
Yeah. So Eolina actually presented about 2 years. Sorry, I'm looking at her case on my computer before I got to see her with the vet that was at this facility prior to me. So she had a mass on the dorsum of her head. It was a pretty good size mass, probably about 8 centimeters in diameter. And they went ahead and did surgical excision of this mass back in September of 2017. They had incomplete resection of the mass on the top of her head just because it was really infiltrative, but they thought they got as much as they could. And they sent it off for histopathology and it came back as a xanthoma. So a xanthoma is actually not a cancerous type of mass, but it is a locally invasive mass that's comprised of bony macrophages, multinucleated giant cells, and cholesterol clefts. And you generally will see them in animals that have kind of altered lipid or fat metabolism. And that kind of brings us to eels under managed care. So our eels are obviously kind of doing things slightly different than what they would be doing in the wild. They are ambush predators in the wild. They don't need to eat quite as often as some other critters because they eat one large meal and then kind of rest and digest for a good period of time. And particularly our temperate species eels are the ones that are in cold water, they have much lower metabolisms than your tropical species. So they probably need to eat even less calories and potentially even less frequently than those other guys. But the thing about eels is that if you don't feed them when they think that they need to be fed, they will then go around munching on your fish in your exhibit. And then you will have many fish presenting to you with lacerations or bite wounds. And so generally speaking, in aquariums, we try to keep all of our guys happy. So we end up feeding the eels to the point where they will not be munching on either fish. And then this tends to lead to them being chubby little moray eels in captivity. And we try to do, you know, the best that we can of providing them a diet that's fairly natural. In the wild, they're eating fish, they're eating various different inverts depending on the species, also a lot of octopus. We don't just go around feeding octopus to our eels, but we do try to feed them Ilex squid, shrimp, and then various types of fish as well. But they tend to develop.
So you're trying to satiate your eels, but not too much, but enough so they don't eat your fish. Would that be a similar principle to other predators like sharks in a multi-species exhibit?
Yeah, it's similar as well. I feel like our sharks don't tend to get quite as obese as the eels for whatever reason. Maybe it's because we feed them more similarly to what they actually eat out in the wild, because most sharks are actually eating fish and like that's something that we can kind of readily get. Octopus, like the small species of octopus, like big eye octopus, is not something that you can buy commercially. So yeah, you could potentially go out and capture those, but nobody has time for that, right? So I like squid, on the other hand, are something that we can capture, but those are not what particularly our species of California moray is eating. So I think that's potentially where we get the disconnect. But you're correct. For sharks, usually we don't have that much problem with them munching on other fish in our exhibits because we do feed them. And so they don't really need to go chasing after other fish because we're hand feeding them multiple times a week. So our eels are similar. At the California Science Center, where this eel is from, we have 6 of them in our main exhibit, and they are all individually identified. So we know who everybody is. It's actually pretty cool. We use something called a veterinary implant elastomer tag, or a VIE tag, which is dye that you can inject underneath the skin of the eel. So all of our larger fish and our elastobranchs are microchips, but obviously you can't tell what a microchip is when you're diving in the water. But we use this VIE tag on their head so that the divers can then know which eel is which. So we have purple left jaw and yellow right jaw, or dot right head, or, you know, whatnot. So Eolina is yellow head. And so that's how the divers know specifically which eel they're out there feeding.
So if they all have microchips, but then you're also doing this VIE, why do they have microchips as well?
Because the VIE can occasionally dissipate over time, or it might be very difficult to see depending on how pigmented the particular animal is. So we actually use this a lot for our various different critters. We're very good at doing almost individual level medicine here at the Science Center. We have a live kelp forest that's about 300,000 gallons, and it has tons of species in there. And anything that's about a rockfish size or larger, our divers are actually individually feeding. You know, so we might have 10 olive rockfish, but they do try to keep track of which olive rockfish are eating, and they'll actually go down and do a dive specifically to feed the olive rockfish and the flag rockfish and the copper rockfish. And then the next dive, they'll feed the black rockfish and the gopher rockfish. And so they do a really, really great job here at this facility of individually targeting animals and base their diets off of their weights, and they all get vitamins every feed. So it's very common to do that for our Lasma Branks at most facilities, but as far as I know, we're one of the only places that is doing that with our teleosts as well, which is pretty cool.
Wow, that's so cool.
Yeah. So for our guys, they are individually fed, so we know if they're eating and whatnot. So when we did get this diagnosis of xanthoma back for Elena, we did go ahead and try to change her diet up. We were feeding more fish and kind of less inverts. And so kind of just looking at the basic nutrient breakdown of things, we actually switched to doing more inverts and less fish because overall they have less fat content. But Ilex squid, which we were feeding because eels do love them, some cephalopods, and shrimp are actually very high in cholesterol though. So we were trying to decrease the level of fat because we were seeing the xanthoma in an Elena, and we had also started to see some hepatic lipidosis or excess accumulation of fat in the liver. So we tried to decrease the fat in their diets, but we inadvertently increased the cholesterol in their diets when we did this.
What would be problematic if there was increased cholesterol in the diet?
So increased cholesterol has specifically been associated with two different things in specifically moray eels. They will get corneal lipid deposition, which is usually comprised mostly of cholesterol. So they'll get that kind of sheen across their corneas, which we did have a couple cases of that. But interestingly, when we shifted their diet around, that actually did resolve, even though we were kind of giving them more cholesterol inadvertently. And then these xanthomas as well, which are kind of associated with cholesterol clefts. So it's kind of depositions of cholesterol in the tissue. And then you get macrophages and multinucleated giant cells coming in and attacking these cholesterol clefts and creating a mass and inflammation around those cholesterol clefts. So I think we're trying to do the right thing by decreasing the overall fat, but the staff increased the shrimp content and the squid content of her diet. And then fast forward 2 years later, she re-presented with the xanthoma on the top of her head. So in October of 2019, the staff started noticing that she was starting to get another little bump on her head. And we were like, okay, well, it's probably a recurrence of the xanthoma. It's not neoplastic. We'll probably just let it be unless it starts to affect her quality of life. And then this mass started growing super quick, got up to about the size of 10 centimeters in diameter. It was starting to squish down on the top of her eyes, so she couldn't really see really well. And it was also causing some buoyancy issues. So because her head was so full of fat, she was kind of head floaty and having some more trouble staying down in the tube. We decided, okay, well, let's go for xanthoma surgery round two. So we proceeded with that in December of 2019. It was not my favorite surgery ever to do. It was a very, very large mass on the top of her head, and it had kind of infiltrated into all those muscles on the top of her head, clear down to her skull. So to remove the entire mass, I really did have to go all the way down to her skull, was kind of trying to scrape it off the top of her skull, also into the muscles that kind of connect into her jaw bones and a little bit back behind her skull as well. So we did our best. Once again, it was not a complete resection of it just because of how invasive it was. And I would start getting into things that she probably needed, you know, like jaw muscles. So we didn't go too deep on those, but we were successful. We did remove it and we submitted it again. It once again came back is a xanthoma. Just of note, we do treat our patients similar to other animals. She got morphine post-op, which is a pain med. She also got meloxicam, and then she got started on an antibiotic called danofloxacin, and she kind of continued on that for a while. Afterwards, she had the incision going from right behind her eyes, clear back past her skull by about 3 or 4 centimeters, and it was kind of a single incision on the top of her head. We were having some pretty severe trouble with post-operative infections along the incision line. So it's not uncommon to see in fish species, little protozoa like mixed ciliates. Those things love to jump on anything that's dead and dying. So if you scrape a fish that has been dead for a minute in a tank, You will generally see mixed species ciliates. Those are guys that are just jumping on dead tissue and trying to digest it. You do not want to see this on your live animals that have incisions that are trying to heal. She also had some mixed species bacteria that we were able to appreciate. So if an animal is really healthy, really robust, you can usually kind of get them through that first couple of weeks where they have that incision, and then their body will take over and start fighting off those infections. But for her, we couldn't get them to heal. We were treating her pretty frequently, doing a bunch of different dips and baths and freshwater rinses on her to try and get rid of those infections. And then finally, at about 3 weeks post-op, she had minimal healing of her incision, and it had started to dehisce or started to come apart. And so I kind of went back in and opened it up thinking maybe I had a deep infection going on that we needed to clear out. And when I got in there, it looked basically like nothing had healed, even though it had been 3 weeks. So the skin just kind of fell apart and there was her skull again. Nothing was attached. It was just kind of hanging out. So we cultured it. It actually didn't grow anything.
Would you have expected much more healing at this point?
Yeah, I would have expected some healing by 3 weeks. Like I said, they're cold water species. Our tank is capped at 54 degrees Fahrenheit, but most tropical eel species, they're capped like 78 degrees Fahrenheit. So I would expect a kind of a normal wound in a temperate species teleost to take about 8 weeks to heal, which might sound like a long time, but that's actually pretty standard for our cold water species. But the fact that this was 3 weeks out and it basically looked like nothing was going on, it looked like I had just done surgery, that was a little concerning. So we did go ahead and do a culture of, took a swab and stuck it way down in there to make sure we didn't have a bacterial infection going on, and actually didn't grow anything. So still a mystery to me why she was having such a bad time. We went ahead and reclosed her skin up over the top, and she was actually doing okay for another about 8 weeks. So like I said, usually that's about the time that I would expect the skin to start to heal, and then maybe we can start to consider taking out sutures. So during this whole 8 weeks, we are still struggling with protozoal infections, mixed species bacterial infections, and I could not figure out what is going on. I'd thrown everything I knew how to throw at this eel. And so I thought, well, maybe because they have so much mucus in their skin and it was actually getting trapped in the sutures, the suture is acting as a foreign material. Could that be her whole thing? She just really hates the sutures. So at 8 weeks out, I went ahead and removed the stitches because it looked like the top layer of skin had healed over. But then after I removed the stitches, we kind of had let her go. About 10 minutes later, the whole thing had dehisced again. And once again, we are staring at the top of this eel's skull. So the skin is not healthy enough for me to pull it back together and trim all the edges back to healthy skin. She can't go around with her skull exposed to seawater. So we had two options at that point. And I think probably most people would have euthanized at this point. And I was really almost leaning that way as well, because you can't just leave her with an open skull. And the other option was, you know, I've done this in other wildlife species. Why don't we try an autogenous skin graft? So that is an autogenous, meaning it's coming from the same animal, versus like a xenograft would be putting the skin of another animal, like a tilapia, onto an eel. That would be a xenograft. So I had done this in a couple other species. I'd done it in a dog during one of my internships, and I'd also done it in a raccoon during a wildlife internship. And so I was like, you know what? I have no idea if this is going to work at all. To my knowledge, it had never been done in any teleost species before, but I had done a surgery on another zebra moray eel at the other facility that I work at. She had gotten bitten on the side and had a huge hole in her side with her ovary hanging out. So we'd actually gotten her through that. And I had learned that eel skin is actually extremely stretchy, which is pretty cool. Most teleosts have scales, and those scales go from the epidermal layer down into the dermal layer. And it really prevents their skin from being able to stretch and move around like mammal skin does. So usually when you have a teleost with a large wound, you just have to let it heal by second intention, because you can't basically stretch it to close back together. But on that other zebra moray eel case, I did find, because eels don't have those scales, you can undermine the skin, meaning remove the connections of the skin from the underlying muscle and stretch it together using tension relieving techniques, and it will get closed. So I was like, you know what, we can take a chunk of skin from her back and potentially transpose it to the top of her head, suture it in place, and then hopefully get that big defect on her back to heal as well.
Did you worry though that that was going to involve more suturing, which previously hadn't worked?
Yes. So like I said, I never really figured out why this first thing didn't work, because I've done a lot of fish surgery, used the same suture type materials. So I was definitely worried it wasn't going to work, but this was her last shot. We're going to try this. And if it didn't work, we were going to euthanize her, but we were going to euthanize her anyway. So we ended up cutting about an 8 centimeter by about 6 centimeter square from her back. And I removed that skin and then placed it on the top of her head, cleaned up all the margins of her head wound, and was able to suture it in place. And then I now have a giant hole on her back. But what it was able to do was once again undermine that skin, so it's no longer connected to the underlying muscle tissue. And then I've heard it called like an envelope pattern. So you bring each side of the square into the middle, and then it kind of looks like an X shape of sutures when you're done, or like an envelope. So we were able to get that closed. It did have a fair amount of tension on it, but it did close, and she had skin graft on her head. Fast forward, we continued to have to do a lot of supportive care for her. She still did struggle with some of those infections. And this is where I kind of developed my new favorite technique of wound care, doing honey and polyox on this eel, because now we're like 4 months into this eel case of not healing. I'm trying everything under the sun. So now it's my new favorite thing. You take Manuka honey, which is a special type of honey made from a Manuka plant, which comes from New Zealand. It is used pretty commonly in humans for things like diabetic ulcers or burns. I used it a ton in wildlife when I was doing my wildlife internship. And I liked it so much. I talked about it all the time when I was at UC Davis doing my aquatic animal health fellowship, that the microbiologists up there got really interested in it. And Dr. Esteban Soto and June Eng, who was another fellow, they did a whole study on Manuka honey in teleos. And they found that it is actually one of the best things that you can do for topical wound care in fish. They compared it to a couple other topical wound care products. And they found that Manuka honey was actually the only thing that helped wounds heal faster. Everything else that they tried actually made the wounds heal slower. Not too surprising, because fish skin is actually really sensitive. It does not appreciate things like chlorhexidine or betadine or alcohol, things that we would use normally on mammal skin. It will just make their skin very irritated and inflamed. So we can't use any of those products on our fish. But everything so far that I've tried putting Manuka honey on loves it, including fish skin. So it's pretty cool. It's too osmotically dense for bacteria to grow into it. It has a pretty low pH of like 3 to 4. So also bacteria don't like to grow into that. The Manuka plant itself has some chemicals in it that prevent the growth of bacteria, viruses, and fungus. So that's why you specifically want to use Manuka honey versus any other type of honey. It also will either promote or decrease the production of reactive oxygen species, and also either promote or decrease certain cytokines as well. Everything to basically help the wound heal faster. So there's lots and lots of cool studies if you're interested in it. The problem with fish is you can't keep it on the wound, right? So you can put a bandage on a dog and keep that in place. Versus our fish, we have the problem of you can put it on the wound, but then it's just going to slide right off once you put them back into the water. So the other thing that we have started combining is something called polyox powder. So it is a powder that was developed for use in humans with oral ulcers, and it comes as a powder in a little puffing container. And you basically puff this powder in a very light coat over the top of the wound. And then when it comes into contact with water, it forms a gel bandage. Dr. Trey Clark actually was one of the first people to start using it in fish, and he called it his voodoo powder. You can mix it with a bunch of different compounds. He used phenytoin and misoprostol, which have been known to help with wound healing. We just get ours compounded with neomycin, which is a topical antibiotic. You can get it compounded with antifungals, though, various different things. But I think the main benefit that it does is that it creates that gel barrier that helps kind of hold stuff in place. So the way you apply it to a wound is you flush the heck out of the wound. I usually use RO water or reverse osmosis water because marine bacteria and marine parasites do not like fresh water. So flush, 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 try to get everything out of there because you don't want to seal any grossness into your wound. Then you have to dry the wound with some gauze. And that is because the honey, if you put it on a wet wound, it just tends to form this honey gel mush that tends to slide all over the place. So you want it to be more like an actual gel consistency. So put that on your wound and then you puff the polyox powder over the top of the honey and then spritz it with RO water and it forms a bandage. And I do that 3 different times. So honey's on the bottom and then it has this polyox bandage covering it over the top to help keep it in place. It doesn't keep it in place for an exceptionally long amount of time, but it'll probably hang in there for 30 minutes to an hour, which is a lot better than 30 seconds. But we did find for Elena that if we went to every other day wound care for her by doing this honey polyox, cleaning out her wound by flushing it. So we found if we did this every other day, we could keep her wound clean. And we finally started to see some healing progress. And it was really cool. The graft, you could tell, was starting to take. It did have a little bit of die off in one of the corners where it didn't take, but pretty much everywhere else, it was starting to take. Things were actually starting to stick to her skull, which was a good thing to see. But it was a long, drawn out process. About 6 months in after we did this skin graft procedure, I knew it was basically gonna take. We still just had a couple areas of inflammation. And then by 1 year after the skin graft procedure, it was when it was actually finally fully healed. So we weren't doing every other day for that long. I think we had to do that for about 2-3 months. And then we switched to once a week. And then once that was good, we just went to like once a month type treatments. We were, of course, supporting her additionally by tube feeding her because eels that are upset will not eat for you. And now she's been running around back in her kelp tank for about a year and a half. And you can see her, she has a little bit of like a divot on the top of her head because I removed so much tissue. She looks like she kind of has a toupee on, which is kind of cute. But everybody loves to see her, and she's the Science Center's poster child. We did our own podcast about her here at the Science Center on our Ever Wonder series. And she was also presented at IAAAM. A little abstract is written up about her. So if you're interested in learning more about it, you can see her case report from last year's IAAAM as well.
What an amazing story. Wow. And it has a happy ending too, which, you know, cases like this don't always do. So kudos to you and your team for taking the chance and sticking it out for Elena. Clearly it paid off.
Yeah. For eels, it's going to take a long time to heal. Even when I've done some tropical species, just plan on it taking probably about 3 months to get them through something. Now that I know more about these temperate species, I would say probably plan on, if nothing goes awry, 6 months for really large wounds for these guys. And while you're supporting them through it, you just do things that you know how to do. You culture things and give them appropriate antibiotics to feed them if they're not eating. We were giving her additionally some vitamin C to help with wound healing, B vitamins. We also started doing Entice, which is a dog product. It's capmorelin, which is a synthetic ghrelin hormone. And I've had some pretty good success using that actually in shark species to get them to eat. I'm not sure if that's what eventually got Elena to eat, but she got the book thrown at her and it eventually worked. All the, you know, time and effort and crazy things that we tried for her, she had a good outcome.
Well, what an incredible story. I loved learning about Elena, and it's so nice. It had a happy ending, and now I know to go buy lots of Manuka honey. So Dr. Stevens, thank you so much for being here today on Aquadox.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Great talking with you.
And that's going to do it for this week's episode of Aquadocs. I'd like to thank Dr. Brittany Stevens for being on the show this week, our sponsors AAFE and WAVMA, as well as all of you, our wonderful listeners, for tuning in. As always, check out our Facebook and Instagram to stay up to date on the latest Aquadocs news. And if you've got an extra moment, please rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts and on Spotify. I'm Michelle Greenfield. Stay healthy, stay safe, and we'll see you next time here on Aquadocs.